Hey, welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We are cleaning up American discourse, one unethical persuader at a time. And they're out there. Got to counter these people. I am Dr. Dan French, American rhetorician, late night comedy writer, and I like to do podcasts. I've brought on a lot of interesting people and we have fun. And I would say this week definitely qualifies. My guest this week is an author, mediation pioneer, academic, internationalist, good dude. I've talked to him a few times. This is going to be fun for me. He chaired two political science departments, Hawaii and Auburn, which, you know, that's some range.
NYU too.
Nice. And
NYU for a long time.
You founded a couple of mediation programs. You've done, you know, multiple books, big academic career. You've had a big career. Everybody welcome Ted Becker.
Thank you,
Dan. Ted Becker.
Nice to be with you, Dan.
Thanks. We were just talking before we came on about how much nicer your room is than mine.
Yeah, and I told him, well, I also, what he doesn't see is that those two kind of shiny things in the back are windows out on a lake. It's a small lake. It's the size of Walden Pond.
Yeah, so are you simplifying? You know, I always thought the simplify. He should have just said that once.
Okay, sorry. I'll be whatever.
It got complicated, right? Too many simplifies. Don't.
Listen, what we were talking about is not simple, that's for sure.
So, like I said, big career in mediation. You've pinged me a few times about what is rhetoric and how does rhetoric help the world. Mediation, you know, I've kind of wandered over the last few years through a shared contact of ours and learned a little bit about it, but just launch in a little bit. What do you see the role of mediation these days in this sort of high conflict world of ours?
Well, I see the role of mediation as being the solution, and I see nobody paying much attention to it other than the wrong people. And I'll give you an example. Biden having that meeting with the 10 Republican senators, Republicans, right?
Yeah. All Republicans.
All Republicans, right. Now, what that was, what you saw was a two-party negotiation, and two-party being Republican and Democrat, and one being president, one being congressional. Why didn't they have a mediator? You tell me. Why didn't they have a mediator from the Carter Center in Georgia or a mediator from Institute of Mediation and Conflict Resolution in New York, where I was trained? I mean, they've been around for 40, 50 years. I mean, there are probably hundreds of thousands of people trained in mediation in America who are very good at facilitating disputes. I mean, they don't even think of having them.
Nobody uses them, right? Like it's not a normal part of our culture.
Right, because this is an adversarial culture and mediation is about conflict resolution, not win or lose.
Well, I think that bothers some people. Like when you think about like Biden and the Republicans, the Democrats and, you know, people who are behind Biden don't want him to give away anything to the Republicans because that means the whole, you know, they're losing if the Republicans start taking away benefits and more money and all that. That's the thought, right?
Yeah, politics is a adversarial game, zero-sum, frequently zero-sum game, although they like to talk about walking across the aisle and...
Well, I think Biden has played that. Biden has kind of a mediator persona after 40 years, you know, in the Senate. Like that was sort of his reputation, at least, that he liked to do that.
Well, I'm no Biden fan. I mean, I didn't vote for Biden. I voted against Trump. I did not vote for Biden. I don't particularly care much for Joe Biden, although I will say he's starting off well.
I'm curious.
What
do you have against Biden?
Oh, well, the first thing I had against Biden really bad was the Clarence Thomas Senate hearing where he was
the chairman. Sure, he screwed that up for sure. Everybody would give you that.
Well, I mean, that started it. I mean, you know, that was a very negative feeling I had about him, the way he treated Anita Hill. So, you know, I mean, he was much younger then, than before his latest tragedy, but he had that tragedy before with losing his wife and daughter. But, you know, I'm not giving him a break for that in terms of how he handles things. And that was a very sexist way he treated her. And, I'm, you know, that bothers me. You know,
always it was bad. I think everybody, that's definitely a hit he took, for sure.
He was a pro-Iraq war. He voted for the Iraq war. I mean, that's a... They keep on talking about conspiracy theories. Well, how about the real conspiracy that actually happened between George W. Bush, Colin Powell, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, and Paul Wolfowitz? I mean, that was a conspiracy. Why aren't they charging them with conspiracy and trying them? I mean, and they put all these conspiracy theorists on from the right wing, and the media keeps on talking about them all the time. I'm thinking to myself, why don't you talk about real conspiracies? Not conspiracies dreamed up by some, you know, extremists on the right wing. You know, anyway, getting back to Biden.
Yeah, get back to the Biden Republican thing, like not using mediators. I'm interested in that.
Well, I mean, that's just one example. I mean, you can't tell me any major international meeting between leaders where they've used a mediator or a facilitating team. Name one. Not a one. Did Trump take a mediator to meet Kim Jong-un? No. Trump really mediated one dispute that very few people know about.
Really?
He played the mediator. And I would say he was a very biased mediator. He wasn't a good mediator, but he got the settlement he wanted.
Okay.
And that was a dispute between Saudi Arabia and Russia over how much oil to produce and the price of oil. And Trump wanted to keep the price up. Both wanted to drop it because they wanted to sell more oil and gain more market share. And Trump figured that that was not good for the United States economy. He wanted the oil companies to be making lots of money. So he wanted the price up. So
If a mediator had been in that meeting with Biden and the Republicans, what would have been different? Like, let people know what that process is, because people
If I were mediated, I was going to say that's a great question, but I hate people to say that on TV or radio because they consider it patronizing. And it's kind of don't use it in mediation. It would be one thing I would be teaching. Never say that to a disputant. That's a good question.
Okay.
Anyway, so here's, I was watching, I saw some TV clips of in the White House, Biden sitting there and the Republicans were all sitting on the other side. First of all, that's bad. They should have had him in a circle, Biden in the middle of a circle. You can see who was at the head of the table, or that they're at different sides. What they are is sitting around the table talking about solving a problem. And it's a big problem. How are we going to fight this virus and get the economy moving? It's one and two. You got to get the virus down before you get the economy moving. But they're linked. So that's the problem. So there they are in an adversarial setting, just the way it was set up, you know. And Biden, there's a disparity of power in this setup. And mediation, that's one of the trickiest things a mediator has to deal with is the disparity in power. You know, if Trump is mediating with Saudi Arabia and Russia in terms of oil, they seem to me to be kind of equal. They're both big producers and way up there. And I guess the U.S. is number one because of fracking, but Saudi Arabia and Russia would be right up there with Iran. Well, of course, Iran is out of the equation because we keep on suppressing them. But as in terms of their reserves and how much they actually pump, they're way up there. I would say not much of a disparity of power there. But in the Biden-Republican meeting, there was a great disparity of power. He's the president, and he's got the Senate and the House majorities. He's meeting with the minority party. He wants to get them to come along with their position. Now, here's the key in this is really very important for people to understand. I'm a true believer of mediation, and I believe in classical, traditional mediation. So keep that in mind. So, and I'm a true believer. I love mediation. It's changed my life. It even kind of, I would say, kept my second marriage limping along for much longer than it would have. My second wife was also a mediator. So we would constantly, well, you're not really listening, and we would go back and forth and that kind of thing. Anyway, so the way they had it set up was an adversarial situation with the power differential. So a mediator between them has to understand that. So how can you lessen the power differential and get them to actually try to work through a solution? So I was thinking, okay, they would talk, let them talk until, you know, they come to the impasse they came to. They didn't get anywhere. I mean, they're in there for 2 hours, I believe. Republicans walked out. There's no agreement. Well, that's the one thing as a mediator you don't want is no agreement. It's called an impasse. It makes you feel bad. You're wasting your time. You know, you tried your best and couldn't get these people to see any common ground. Well, there's plenty of common ground. So as a mediator, I would have taken Biden aside. You know, first, okay, you got to talk with each side privately after they put forth their positions. And you got to find out what's really their interests. Now, that's the key thing in mediation, as conflict resolution. It's got nothing to do with the law. It's got nothing to do with truth. We don't care about truth. We don't care about the law. All we care about is solving the problem to each party's satisfaction. They both get something out of it. And the way you do that, in a sense, is making sure. So if I were talking to Biden, I would say, is this merely rhetoric that you're talking? You know, you want to talk about uniting America, and you think that bringing Republicans into an agreement on this particular piece of legislation would kind of show that Congress and the president are willing to work together, et cetera. Is this really what you want? Is this in your interests as president of the United States and as a Democratic Party looking towards the 2022 election? And he would say, yes, that is in my interests, but if they won't budge, I'm willing to shove it down their throats, because I think it's more important that the American public gets this help to stop the COVID, to get the COVID into full retreat, and to start to build the economy. And if they won't come along, bipartisanship is secondary. That's the way I feel about it. Okay, I say, okay. Well, how about this? They have told you, I heard them say in their opening argument, that they are willing to go ahead on the COVID relief part of it, a full on, 160 billion or something like that. Why can't you just come and make that part of an initial agreement and get it passed? They also said they're willing to, there were about four or five sticking points between them. So on this, there's an agreement. We call that in mediation common ground, a mutuality of interests. Republicans certainly have as much of an interest in beating back COVID and starting to get the economy moving as the Democrats and Biden. So that would be, okay, one piece of a partial agreement. Why weren't they talking about a partial agreement? Why does that be all or nothing at all?
I think that's politics, right? Like political, in order to get political power, they often group things together that don't really belong together so that they can get the weaker ones through based on the stronger ones.
Yeah, and the Democrats could, and Biden may say, well, look, we got the majority. We won Georgia because we got the people in Georgia to buy into all of this package. And that's why we got the majority in the Senate, and why we can push it through the reconciliation process. And I would look at Biden as a facilitator and say, reconciliation, that's a euphemism for ramming it down someone's throat. You have a very slim majority and you want to pass it just the way you want it. You want them to come along so it seems bipartisan, but you're not willing to give anything. Is that right? I mean, does anybody talk to him that way?
I don't know.
I doubt it. I doubt it. Because I don't think any of the people he hires are facilitators and mediators. He hires people who are experts in certain areas to give him advice. He doesn't hire a facilitator.
Yeah, I don't guess there is a secretary cabinet level mediator, is there?
I doubt it. I doubt it. Now, there may be some lawyers who believe they're mediators that he hires, but they're not. They're two separate paradigms entirely. I mean, when I say lawyer, I mean attorney, because I'm a lawyer. You know I'm a lawyer, right? I have my law degree. I work for Attorney General of the state of New Jersey. I worked for two blue ribbon law firms in Newark, New Jersey. I just hated it. My father was an attorney. All my best friends in New Jersey, and they're my longtime best friends since high school, are all attorneys. Well, they're all retired now, but they all have wonderful careers and they're all great guys. So you can't say I hate lawyers, but I know intellectually, conceptually, and in practice, the lawyer-attorney model is the exact opposite of a mediator model. Two different mindsets, oil and water, they don't mix. Now, occasionally you will find a guy who's an attorney who starts to hate being an attorney and then becomes a mediator. There are some of those around I've met. But if you're a practicing attorney, retired judge, I mean, I laugh at all these retired judges who are mediators.
Right.
I mean, what a joke. The first thing you teach in mediation training is it's non-judgmental. You've got to be non-judgmental. Now, how do you get a retired judge to be non-judgmental?
That's literally in his name, judge, right?
Right, and they act it. I mean, this is their personality. This is their value system. This is their whole life's work. And they all think they've done a great job. They're not retiring because they think they're incompetent. Are there incompetent judges? Sure there are. There's incompetent everything, doctors, mediators, professors, et cetera. But most of these judges who retire and make a lot of money doing mediations were successful. So, you know, how can they be non-judgmental? It's impossible. So that's the way I would be trying to really get at what is Joe Biden's interest. Then I'd go to the Republicans and I'd say, okay, why are you here? You know you're in the minority. You know, with the reconciliation process that Mitch McConnell came up with about 8 years ago, starting with Obama, that you can ram anything through or block anything if you've got the majority in the Senate and in the House. Presidents pretty much handcuffed other than these executive agreements and WUs, what we call signing agreements. I always had a laugh at those. You know what signing agreements were? He would sign something into law that was passed by the Congress. And then after, you know, he'd give the pens out, most kind of thing. Then he would take another thing that had been written up by his lawyers that said he wasn't going to abide by it and sign that. It was called a signing agreement. Well, that sounds like it's unconstitutional to me. He's pledged to uphold the law they just signed. And then he has a signing agreement that says he's not going to follow it, not going to execute it. No one ever said anything about that. You know, I mean, there's so much BS that goes on in politics, and the media totally misses it.
Well, it's too complicated for most people, right? I mean, you've done this for, you know, almost 60 years, and you've watched law and mediation and everything else. You've got a lot of complexity in the way you look at this. Most people are coming at even their conflicts and things like this brand new, fresh, with no training whatsoever.
I mean, the amount of ignorance about American government and how it works is astounding. And I'm talking, you know, I was dealing with honor sections in a pretty widely respected, you know, land-grant university in the South that attracted, you know, top students from around the entire Southeast, and occasionally drips and drabs from the rest of the country. And it was, whether it was private school, public school, the ignorance was like astounding to me. Now, to be honest, when I got out of high school back in 1950, I was no better prepared for college than these kids were, to be honest. I mean, high school American government, social studies, civics.
Yeah, I mean, that's not the time to be educating people. When you're 15 years old, you're not absorbing a lot of complex stuff about the government.
Right. And also, my father, who was an attorney, was a real right-wing Republican extremist. And he used to constantly, I mean, I'm a kid, you know, growing up hearing this, and even into high school, my father kept on calling Franklin Roosevelt communist. So I thought Roosevelt was a communist. I mean, you know, how do you know? You know, you don't really talk about it in school with your friends and this sort of thing. I mean, I didn't know anything about it. So, I mean, I was pretty
young. Back then, that was like, I mean, there was a real chance people were actually were communists back then, right? I mean, it was a party in the country.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There was one. My mother had a friend whose husband was a millionaire slumlord who was a communist. And he was the most dogmatic man and really patronized me all the time. When I was starting to learn something about politics and history in college, he would always put it down because it didn't go with Marxist ideology.
Right.
I've never been a Marxist, and because he turned me off to it, how arrogant he was about it. Once I finally got to study it, Marx himself turned me off to it. But,
Go to the primary source and dislike it. Yeah.
Right. Oh, God, try to read Karl Marx. Jeez. Impenetrable stuff, particularly as a dialectical materialism. What? Don't ask me. I never could figure it out. Anyway, so getting back to talking to the Republicans. So as a facilitator or mediator, go to the Republicans and say, okay, look, he's kind of set in his position, which is this $1.8 trillion thing. And he wants you to come along with it entirely and to show that you guys can get along. And they'll say, well, what's in it for us? Our people didn't vote for him. It's not going to help us gain any kind of votes in 2022 if we go along with it. We're just going to look weak. You know, what's in it for us? So that's what I would have. That would be a problem for me to say, okay, well, I asked the president whether or not he'd be willing to just maybe take pieces of it where you have agreement. And you pass just those and still have negotiating time for over the rest of it. How would that suit you? I mean, you're already in agreement on these things. Would you be agreeable? Would it be in your interests to show a bipartisanship, given the fact how polarized everybody knows we are in this country? As that would be in your interest to show that the Republican Party is not just ideological and adversarial, but can actually negotiate something that's for the benefit of the country. Would that be in your interests? So that's what a mediator facilitator might do, which did not happen in that meeting between the president and those 10 Republicans.
So would you put politicians in the same corral then? Like, I know lawyers are, you know, it's an adversarial occupation, and judges and all that. But politicians are built at least somewhat on the art of compromise and sort of backroom agreements and things like that. So they've got more sophistication towards mediation, I would think.
Every legislator or governor or judge, and they're politicians with black robes, as I've always said, judges, are into adversarial. Politics are strictly adversarial. There's no negotiating. When they go out of the stump and they're talking, they even take more extreme positions, sure, particularly in primaries, because the people who show up for their talks in primaries are usually the extremes of both parties. So they really, you know, take it to the edge. Each side, Democrats, Republicans, Greens, or whoever might be involved, you know, to get their base all riled up, and so they'll go out and knock on doors and, you know, do the work on social media and the rest of it. So no, I think politicians are just like professional athletes, adversarial. They don't negotiate.
So that's one of your big villains in the world, then, adversarialness.
Yes. Yes. Well, isn't it the problem? I mean, what's the problem between China and the United States? I mean, we're 8,000 miles apart. You know, why is the United States sending its aircraft carriers in between, in the Taiwan Strait between China and Taiwan? Is it, you ask the Navy, well, why are you sending those aircraft carriers into the Strait, Taiwan Strait? We're just doing routine operations to show the freedom of navigation. Well, how about if the Chinese send their boats into the Gulf of Mexico and surveillance planes along the Florida coast? And they say, we're just testing our freedom of navigation. They'd be blown out of the water and shot down inside of an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So it's adversarial to the max. The Chinese, by the way, are very different than we are.
Yeah, they're Chinese.
They're very different than we. Mediation is very big in China. In fact, it's the primary mode of dispute resolution in China.
And why is that? Is that just a cultural acceptance of it? Have they done a better job of selling it?
Well, I think it's cultural. It's cultural. It's not the Chinese Communist Party. It's been, if you read the Tao by Lao Tzu, I mean, it's all about harmony and balance. Confucius is also about maintaining a social harmony and balance, not necessarily between individuals. And Confucius is, the Chinese culturally, in terms of their ethical system, since they're not a religious society, are very prone to have been for centuries, if not millennia, using mediation as a primary way of resolving interpersonal disputes, small crimes, things like that.
Interesting.
Japan as well.
When you said that, you think of the bifurcation at the center of that culture, a series of bifurcations of the yin and yang, the fact that they start with the premise that there are two sides to everything that are different, but find places to conjoin. America mm-hmm. doesn't do that. America is very mono, right?
Well, as you say, it's two side bifurcation, binary, zero sum, win, lose. I mean, that's, it's a dog eat dog world. Survival of the fittest, all this kind of thing. And in China, it's more social harmony and harmony. I mean, this is not to make them out to be perfect beings, because they have lots of conflict and marital affairs and, neighbor stuff. I mean, just the same as we have. I mean, human beings are human beings, and they're going to find ways of not getting along. And you want a third party to come in and try to calm things down, try to show where there's some mutuality of interest, maybe think of some solutions that you haven't thought of before.
Right.
I mean, it isn't necessarily two sides. It can be multi-sides. You see it only as two sides. Yeah, but how about this? Mediators, the last resort of mediators is to suggest options that they haven't brought up in their talks. Well, what about this? Or might this? Why wouldn't you think this might work? Like going back to the Biden Republican thing. Why wouldn't it work that you pass together maybe one third of the bill and agree on that? And say, well, Biden wouldn't do that because he says he's got to hurry it through, and if we won't hurry, he's going to push it through anyway. And say, well, yeah, that you want to say, would you agree that you're willing to do that? And I can go back and talk to him about that and see whether or not he can see it being in his interest, and maybe give a deadline to you guys as to when you've got to come along with the other, or push the rest of it through.
You definitely have the feeling of a mediator, Ted. I want to agree with you.
It's part of me. I say, I remember when I took my mediation training, I was trained by an outfit that I did some research for this podcast, and I found out that the outfit that trained me back in 1979-80 still exists. It's called the Institute of Mediation and Conflict Resolution in New York City. It was one of the first. They were, they still exist. And the guy that trained me was a Black guy named Jeff Jefferson. And he was like one of their top mediators. And we paid, my second wife and I, we paid, since the university wouldn't give us any money to do mediation training, couldn't get it out of my department chair. And we really didn't have any money. I was a renter in Hawaii, never owned any land. And so we borrowed from the Bank of Hawaii $4,000 at the time to pay him to come out and do the training and also, you know, pay for his hotel room, et cetera. So it was a week-long training. All standard mediation trainings are 40 hours. So he came out and he gave the training. And I remember him telling me as a parting shot that I was a terrible mediator. I was too much of a lawyer, he said. And my second wife, he said, she's great. Well, we did a lot of co-mediation. She is a good mediator. But I think over the years, I've come to understand that if you do a lot of mediation trainings, you begin to become a better mediator. There's no way to become a better mediator than actually do trainings. Because, you know, you go through the same simulations over and over again, and students handle it differently, and you see the way they are handling it, and you have to adjust the way you thought it would come out. I mean, you just get to see it in so many different ways. So it makes you into a much better mediator.
Again, like as a rhetorician, as somebody who pays attention to the effects of the language choices, you know, that an area makes, you know, as one of my sort of hyper areas of focus, like mediation itself as a word is a pretty abstract, undefinable word.
Yeah.
Don't you think Google that's a problem? Like when people hear it.
Google it and the first thing that comes up is meditation.
Right? You know, it's already co-occupied by a lot of that kind of spiritualism and meditation and, you know, that kind of history. But I don't really think that's what it is anymore, right? It's not that 70s gestalt psychology group therapy kind of thing, is it?
Well, I told you I'm a hardliner. Actually, I think mediation is very spiritual. And I consider it to be an important part of my spiritual growth, mediation. And I remember when we set up our second center in Hawaii, was set up with the city and county of Honolulu, called it the Honolulu Mediation Network, Honolulu Neighborhood Mediation Network. And we operated out of City Hall, and we had four separate centers around the island. And two of them were in Hawaiian kind of communities, because that's where a lot of the conflict was taking place. Because it was sort of, you know, like rundown areas, economically deprived, educational discrepancies and crime disparities and that kind of thing. So two of our mediation centers in the city county of Honolulu, one was in Waimanalo and one was in Nanakuli. And that was over the big Hawaiian section. And I was working with some Hawaiian, native Hawaiians, there aren't many of them left in Hawaii. And they would say, well, how come you're not going to do Ho'oponopono? And so let me tell you about Ho'oponopono. Ho'oponopono is the Hawaiian mediation. Traditional, goes all the way back to their huna days, way before King Kamehameha, when there was no unified Hawaii, there were different cultures on all the different islands. And the Hawaiians have a lot of gods, and so like the Greeks. And Ho'oponopono was you had to have a religious, what do you call it? Jesus. kahuna, a religious kahuna, to come in and do the Ho'oponopono. And they have to go through a ritual before they start the mediation, and they go through a spiritual ritual after the mediation. So it's a very spiritual conflict resolution process. And I said to my friends, some of whom were our mediators in our center, I said, we can't do it in the University of Hawaii setting, and we can't do it city, county, and Honolulu because of separation of church and state. I said, I've been a member of the ACLU, I just can't do it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but it can be. The Hawaiians consider it very spiritual. Chinese don't consider it spiritual.
I mean, Americans don't. It's not part of American, like, we don't get together and, you know, there's no spirituality in our conflict, is there?
Well, I don't know. I guess you could say that when people are, you know, conflicting over something they consider their deepest interest, like who's going to be in custody of the child, you know, and that kind of thing, or who's going to get the money. You know, it gets down pretty much raw into their deepest emotions, which I think, you know, they get deep anger and hate. You know, is that spiritual? Yeah, negative spirituality, I think.
But they don't pray over it. It's not like a tradition that, like, we're importing, because there are things you can import from the Bible and the Torah and everything else that would help you with conflict. Clearly, there's a lot of conflict advice in there.
I when I do my mediation trainings and or teach conflict resolution to intro conflict resolution at the Tech University, which I taught for 30 years, I frequently will say, as Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers, for they are the children of God. And I believe that. I believe we're blessed.
Well, I think it's interesting, like, when you take, you know, American capitalism, you take our hardcore individualism culture, the fact that we're essentially a predatory culture, you know, like, I do a bit sometimes when I like talking about politics and comedy because it's, and social issues, because it's a difficult topic, which means you've got to do really well to be successful. And I do a thing about where I just explore topics sometimes with the audience. And I'll ask who here thinks we should be allowed to hunt, you know, and almost everybody raised their hand. And I'm like, well, I noticed there are no hooves going up. You know, the predators are the ones that are always voting on this.
You're right.
Like the prey.
I noticed hooves.
You know, there's not a lot of prey vote in here, I see. So, you know, American culture is predatory, it's aggressive, it's individualistic, and you have to take all that into account, right, when you do mediation here. Are you trying to import things that aren't culturally familiar or acceptable in American culture? Like, it's a little too soft for them? You know, is that something that you run into with mediation?
Okay, well, no, I think that, here's what I think. I mean, it's very, in the introductory spiel in every mediation, I'm talking about real mediations now, not what lawyers do, that they call mediation. Lawyers are in the South. I don't know if it's true in New Jersey or California, et cetera. But in the South, it's been totally co-opted by attorneys. And they've corrupted it so bad that you can't even recognize it. But I'm talking about in classic mediation, which still exists in the United States. I've looked up a whole bunch of things. And as I say, IMCR is operating in the Bronx. And actually, there's one in Hawaii that's kind of, I would say, my grandchild, called Mediation Center of the Pacific, which is it's not lawyers. It isn't court attached or anything. So there is community mediation around America. So how is that? Well, again, going back into history, first of all, America, when it was first founded in the 17th century by the Brits, and keep in mind the Spanish were already here in the 16th century, and they were Catholic. They didn't mediate, they assassinated, killed, and murdered, and plundered with the church's blessing. However, the American church.
They mediated between life and death.
Yeah, right. We live, you die.
And death won a lot of the
people. Right.
Yeah.
So in America, though, you had two separate original colonies. One was Jamestown, which was commercial. It was funded by rich Brits, and they wanted to make money off of it. And they immediately started with slaves and indentured servants in order to have free labor. However, the one up in Massachusetts, starting with Plymouth Landing, but mostly Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1630 when John Winthrop came over on the Arabella. If you read his speech on the Arabella, where he talks to 100 or so souls, the Puritans who are going to establish the Massachusetts Bay Colony in Boston, and Boston ultimately, it's very Christian oriented, very, we have to love our brothers and we have to give to each other and we want to be a Christian community. And this is the shining city on the hill speech. Unfortunately, that didn't apply too well to the Native Americans that were around. And unfortunately, John
wasn't Winthrop, a shining teepee on the hill.
Well, it may have shined once they set fire to him.
Yeah.
But, you know, there was a whole, it's very interesting to go back and watch that colony evolve.
Sure.
The Massachusetts Bay Colony, because it was, they were called Congregationalists, and they were not supposed to have a clergy and a hierarchy. They were supposed to just have congregations, and that's kind of the basis of New England town meetings. Mm-hmm. Where Christianity and democracy kind of work, and you're supposed to deliberate. It's sort of like with the Quaker meetings.
Right.
They're democratic. And the Quakers are a very democratic Christian sect. And the congregations were supposed to be, but that's not the way it worked out. They evolved into a hierarchy very quickly, although some of the congregations didn't buy into it. Particularly one run by a woman named Ann Hutchison. And she continued to, she didn't go to the mass meetings that Winthrop was presiding over. And, they were Calvinists and they believed in predestination.
Right.
Well, actually, they weren't very good Calvinists because they really believed that certain people were chosen. Sounds like the Jews. But they believed certain people were chosen. And of course, it was them.
I always find they're always, you're always, your group is always the choice. Like,
right.
Yeah, God made a choice and it's not us. We're out.
Right, so anyway, so Christianity has nothing but peace and love for the other in it. It's not adversarial at all.
That's true.
Now, so I would say that American culture is kind of split by the capitalism of the Jamestown model. And the actual, congregational spirit of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. And then with the Quaker, when Penn took over and got Pennsylvania as a land grant and started the Quaker colonies in Philadelphia. I mean, they were extremely democratic and they got along very well with the Indians, the Native Americans.
Yeah, it's an odd, schizophrenia or bipolarness of, that kind of the effectiveness of power in this country, how effective it's been for the groups that use it well.
Yeah.
And to try to convince them that, hey, you need to stop using that power because it's going to, blow everything up. That's never been a really strong rhetorical appeal, I've noticed.
These power guys, I mean, really. That's why I say the lawyers, the attorneys, and I can't say all attorneys. As I say, my friends who are all attorneys, I love them all. They're really great people, and they're not like that. Personally, I haven't observed them in the courtrooms, but my first cousin was the top family law divorce guy in New Jersey and New York City for decades. And he's a mediator type of personality. And I mean, he talked enough about his cases to me that I knew that he was actually mediating. I mean, being the top divorce attorney, he's mediating amongst very rich people, celebrities, CEOs, top professionals, top surgeons, top this and top that, with lots of money. So they are, you know, at the, you know, in the 0.001 percent. And, you know, he had to get them to give because he wasn't going to go for the throat.
Right. Well, when you're dealing with two power centers going for the throat, like go for either throat, they're going to come back at you. You know, that's the thing about power. It doesn't go quietly into that good night.
Well, you know, in a sense, I consider myself a loser in terms of the success of mediation in America. I think mediation in America, real mediation is the tail that's not wagging. The dog is eating away and chomping away and getting bigger and bigger, and the tail isn't getting any bigger. It's just kind of hanging there.
Well, that's why I say it. I think you have some rhetorical problems. I think a good rhetorician would come in and be like, okay, this word, this mediator word may not be servicing you correctly. We may need a new word.
Well, I don't know what they call it in Chinese. I did read what they call it in Japanese. No, there are different languages have different words for it. You can't call it anything else but what it is. I mean, it is mediation. I mean, it's known around.
Mediation is just the cover word for it. Like, that's just a word that we've plucked out of, you know, English and dropped on top of it. You know, the thing about rhetoric is like when you are being underserved, like if you're the tail and you're like, hey, I want to wag this dog, you know, then rhetoric can come in and go, well, let me give you some tools and tactics for maybe, you know, doing that. Because just asking for the dog to let you wag it isn't working. You know, right. So, you know, with a little more technique and a little more sophistication, you might, you know, it's sort of exactly what you're talking about with solutions.
The other things that happened, right, that don't work either.
What?
The lawyers themselves came up with this to talk about mediation. There was a big conference in Minnesota in around 1976, before I got involved. And it was called the, the Pound Conference. Was it Ezra Pound? Was he a poet?
He was a poet.
You know, okay, so it was, I forget his first name, but somebody Pound Conference. And it brought together a bunch of very top of the line, important people, like Harvard and Columbia law professors, union negotiators, federal negotiators. There'd been a federal mediation service in the United States since the 1930s when the National Labor Relations Act was passed. I think the Wagner Act in 1935. There'd been a federal mediation service. There were federal mediators, people from who did arbitration, and some lawyers. And they had a meeting because of, in 1976 as now, there's always a huge backlog of cases in the courts. And the judges are always complaining, and the judiciaries are always complaining, the head administrators are always complaining, the lawyers are complaining, and there's not enough lawyers to go around for all the conflicts. So there's a huge, huge backlog. So back in 76, you know, they had this big conference, and they came up with a different word than mediation for it. ADR. Alternative dispute resolution.
It's an awful name. They needed rhetoricians. Those are terrible choices.
They came up with, I'm sorry, the mediators, the lawyers, the anthropologists, whoever, they figured that an acronym would do.
No, it's just like, you know how you look at, like we started this by you saying all these politicians coming together. Why don't they have a professional mediator in there that will make it all work better? I look at this and I'm like, all the people coming together to make a language change. Why don't they have a professional rhetorician in there to help them do it better?
Oh, yeah, rhetorician. And there's a much better word for the average person to understand than mediation.
Rhetorician's great. Nobody knows what it is.
Exactly. Nobody knows what mediation is either.
Yeah, but I think with mediation, people think of like divorce mediation. They've already got a negative connotation with mediation, you know?
Well, it's a dispute resolution process. That's what it is.
Right, but that's again, that's technical. That's not a living, breathing, you know, word.
I mean, I can't think of anything but conflict resolution tool. I mean, whatever whatever you're going to say, that's what it is.
No. We got to bring you over into the rhetoric world, man.
Well, what's a court?
What do you mean?
I thought it was something where the jokers and the musicians played for the king.
What are you talking about?
Court. What's a court?
What's a court?
Yeah.
Well, that's one of those, like almost all of our words do multiple things, right? And that's often a problem, you know. So it's the king's court, and then it's the law court, right?
And courting.
Basketball court.
Courting.
Courting.
That scares everybody.
Yeah, all those words are problematic.
Right, right. So, you know, you live with it, you know, believe me, when I began in Hawaii, I was going around trying to sell this mediation to neighborhood boards, you know, and they say, isn't that, you mean meditation? No. Although, you know, with Ho'oponopono, you start off with a meditation after the ritual. And actually, I think there have been some experiments done, and I don't mean in a scientific way where they did any data, but some mediation people have tried to do meditation. They get each party to meditate for 5 minutes before they give their positions. I'm okay with that.
What if Biden and the 10 Republicans had all had to hold hands or sit on the same couch?
Well, sit around a table. That helps. If you sit around a table, there's no hierarchy.
How about beanbags?
Across from each other. You'll notice that in almost all the international mediations, they have a rectangle table where one side sits on the other, and maybe some resource people sit at the ends. But it's adversarial, right from the start. I mean, a circle is very democratic, non-hierarchical. Why don't they sit in a circle? You don't have to hold it.
That would feel weird.
Well, that's the way I do all my mediations. If we have tables, I make it a square.
Well, I think you're right. I think this is the type of stuff that it is disruptive about. When I say it, you know, that would feel weird, I said that on purpose, because all the things that are normative in our culture that work against good mediations are things that you've got to break down, right?
Right. Well, you know, there are two different kinds of mediation, by the way. One is where the court tells you to go to mediate. That's where most people are coming across mediation. The court says, you got to go for mediation. And by the way, that's becoming de rigueur routine in American courtrooms, because that's the way the judges can get rid of the cases. And now they're sending mediation to lawyers. And the lawyers are charging legal fees to mediate. Most mediation that's done not by lawyers is volunteer. And why do people do it? Because they feel good about doing it.
Yeah, that is an awesome feeling.
Good about doing it.
Solve something that lets two people flow on into their lives. Sure.
Oh, I always felt that every mediation I did, I felt that I was better than any play I ever saw. And you were in front seat. And then when you get them alone in the private meetings, like this person doesn't have any idea who I am, and they are spilling their guts. They're telling me things that I wouldn't have believed in terms of that first, when they were first talking to each other, yelling and screaming at each other, you know, about their marriage or what the other one does with the kids or the adulteries and the frauds that are committed. I mean, they made all kinds of crimes and horrible things to you. It's like amazing. It's a mystical process, I'm telling you. You say that's spiritual. It is spiritual.
I mean, I can definitely see that.
And you know, so you're like in front row, and then you're backstage with the actors, and they're telling you all kinds of things about how they hate the other actor, you know, and you know, oh God! And then, and the reason why they are is because you have told them right up front, before it even starts, that anything they tell you, and you repeat it when you're in the room with them alone, is confidential, and you're not taking any notes. So even if they don't agree and they go to court and they want to call you as a witness, you say, I don't remember. And you don't have any notes to refresh your recollection, which is the big thing in terms of witnesses, eyewitnesses. So anyhow, so Because it is a mystical, magical process that works beautifully. And if the court sends you to mediation, your chances of getting an agreement are much less than if both parties have sought out mediation and voluntarily come. They want to try this as an alternative to the courts.
So that's got to feel frustrating to you. I mean, this is your life's work. You know it deeply. You've had, you know, massive amount of experience with it and thought about it down to its very, very, you know, tiny roots, but you can't get it to take hold in America.
Failure. Failure. I believe that my karma is to fail.
Really?
Yeah.
Why is that?
I failed at other things too. I mean, I feel my karma is to fail in terms of all the things I predicted were going to happen. In the last book I wrote called Three Kings of Chaos, I make it very, very clear in talking about the three kings are Putin, Xi Jinping, and Donald Trump. And I say very explicitly in the book that the main game that Xi Jinping, they're all playing different games. Putin plays chess. And by the way, I bet you didn't know this. When he was in the KGB, what was his specialty?
Don't know.
Chess. They have an actual training of KGB chess and geopolitical strategy.
Huh.
So that was his specialty. So Donald Trump is going against a master. Now, Garry Kasparov says Putin is not a good chess player. Oh, well, really? Maybe not a good chess player, but he's a damn good geopolitical chess player.
Well, you know, you're not comparing him to other chess masters, dude. You're comparing him to other world leaders who know nothing about what he's doing.
Right, including Trump. Trump thinks he knows what he's doing. You know, Trump is just, I would say, on Putin's chessboard, he wouldn't be a queen. He wouldn't be a bishop. At best, he's a knight, probably a rook. On Putin's chessboard, he's no more than a rook or a knight.
Yeah,
he might even be a pawn, as far as I know.
But, I don't know. He's a pretty important pawn. Sometimes the pawn captures the king, right?
So. Right. That's right. It can happen sometimes. But anyway, and Xi Jinping, he plays a totally different thing called Weishi, or in Japanese called Go, and we call it Go in English. And it's a board game that looks just like a matrix. It's, you know, just grooves in wood that cross each other. And they're just round white and black stones. And you put each stone on where there's an intersection of lines. And the object is who wins is who surrounds more of the opponent's pieces. Different than chess.
Yeah, I've never even heard of it.
Yeah, well, that's what Xi Jinping is playing. And the alliance with Russia, the whole goal is to control geopolitically the world island. And they're well on their way to doing it. They're well on their way to doing it. It's a big win for him. I think he's making a big mistake in challenging the U.S. on Taiwan. I don't think he doesn't want to go to war over Taiwan with the United States, but I think given what I know about him so far, I wouldn't be surprised if the U.S. can't provoke him into it. If he gets the Taiwanese to say that they want to be independent officially, there'll be a third world war. That is not in Xi Jinping or China's interest, I'll tell you that. Because first of all, it will be a huge battle. Taiwan will be the biggest loser.
Yeah, I would think so.
Oh yeah, it'll be a battleground.
Well, isn't it interesting, like when you pull up game theory, you know, and you apply it to politics, it's interesting to me because it's something you can also do with mediation, right? Mediation is a type of game. And you're having trouble, like people they're not used to playing that game in our country. Mm-hmm. They don't know the moves. They don't know the pieces. They don't know the rules. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I run into a lot with. People don't know the rules of very useful well-developed, sophisticated systems. They're just, they've never been trained into those systems. And so mm-hmm. they end up rejecting them without even knowing what they're rejecting.
Right. Well, I agree with you. I never thought of it as a game, but actually, in a way, it goes against my grain when you say it's a game. I'm thinking it's a very spiritual process. But, you know, in looking at it, I think it's fair. I think it's fair. You know, not that you're playing it for fun, but not that you're playing it to win. Because the mediator, the win in the game is getting the parties to both feel they won.
Yeah, so that's the nature of that game, is that everybody has to win or nobody wins.
Right, right. And I remember one mediation in particular that I did in Hawaii. It was in that Hawaiian area. We as mediators, we went to where the parties were. We didn't make the parties come to us. And I went out to, it was a recreation center out in Nanakuli. And it was a very, very, you know, small stakes thing, you know, interpersonal thing. It was involved a firehouse and basketball games that they used to play at the firehouse. And they were, one guy had become persona non grata, a Filipino guy. And some of the Hawaiian firemen really were, they didn't like the way he played basketball, and they kind of ostracized him. And he was very upset about it, ruined his life. You know, that was the most important thing to him, playing the basketball. And I did it with one of my Hawaiian friends, who was one of the co-meet. We did three-person panels, which I think is the best, to be honest, for a lot of reasons. I won't get into it. And one of the mediators was my only close Hawaiian friend that I had one more years in Hawaii, because I was a male in Hawaii. And unless you marry into Hawaiian culture, you're an outsider. I was an occupier. So this guy was my friend, and he and I worked together very well as mediators. And I remember when we got the agreement, that those guys walked out with their arms around each other. And I just felt like, oh boy. I'll tell you another mediation that I did when I felt that way, and what happened, what I did. It was a mediation at a large state university in Virginia. And the guy who was the provost had been a dean at my school. And he knew some of the work I had done at my school and in Hawaii. And he hired me. It's the only mediation I ever got paid for. And it was a dispute among the faculty of the School of Communication, who had a dean and about 15, 20 faculty. And they were about to undergo an accreditation process. And the provost's interest was that they get accredited, because they had about 500 majors. And them not getting accredited would have been a stain on the school and on that major and all those kids. So he arranged a mediation where I was the mediator and the 15 faculty members and the dean were all in the same room. It was in the Virginia Historical Society in Richmond. And I started out by saying, okay, let's hear, because I didn't know what the dispute was. Oh boy. For a couple of hours they went, and it was a square table.
A lot of energy in faculty and administration conflicts.
Well, he was having an affair with one of the assistant professors. His wife was suing him for divorce. Some of the professors had let that known to the school newspaper, which published it. And there was the dean was suing them for libel. It was incredibly complex.
Yeah, it sounds like a mess.
A mess. Well, I flew up to Richmond once for 4 hours, and I told them what I needed them to think about after it was over, and did some individual meetings with groups of them. And I went back and I flew up a couple of weeks later, another 4 hour session, and they all came to an agreement. and how they were going to handle things and drop lawsuits and agree until after the accreditation and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And they'll work together for the accreditation and the various teams and things like that. And I remember I went back to the row house in which they had rented for me for the evening. And I got in and I went to my bed and I got down on my knees and I prayed to God and said, thank you, Lord, for letting me do this. The money didn't matter. It was such a thrill to be able to help so many people out of their agony and to be able to come together and do something good for their students, 500 students, and not carry their animosity, let their animosity towards each other foul the lives of so many other people. It was a wonderful feeling. And I thank God for the opportunity.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think, you know, things like that where you, like what you just said about not most mediation doesn't charge, like you didn't get paid for it and things like that. Nobody knows that about mediators. Nobody knows that this is a, you know, done out of the goodness of your heart in order to, you know, facilitate a better world for other human beings.
Yeah.
You know,
the best one of them, there's one great one in San Francisco called Community Boards. You ever heard of them?
Mm-mm.
Oh, God. They're wonderful. Community Boards of San Francisco has been around. The guy who founded it attended that conference in Minnesota. His name is Ray Schoenholtz. He was an attorney. And I don't know where he got trained or anything, but he came up with a mediation process. I remember. He was actually a Saul Alinsky community organizer. His basic thing in life was to help communities organize in order to solve problems, to make them sit and get a sense of their community and work together to solve a problem. This is a great story. Anyway, but it was a very formal process that he had. They had four mediators. They didn't have any private meetings at all. Everything was orchestrated in terms of moving through the various steps of mediation in public. Anybody from the community, they had a central office in the mission, mission area of San Francisco, downtown, a real seedy area. And they had four satellite offices in different parts of San Francisco. So I went to one of their mediations and it was a extremely formal arrangement where everybody, you know, the community was invited to come. Each one of their satellite offices had a newspaper that they would put out about all the disputes that they were resolving that they would then give out to various bars, stores.
Interesting. So they made it very public.
Right. In their community about the various disputes there were. So in one particular one, this wasn't the one I saw, but I heard about it. They told me about it. The big problem was parking spaces because there were no driveways. They were like row houses, house after house after house. So everybody more or less had their parking spots on the street. But having lived in New York City with the alternate side parking, I know that can cause lots of conflict.
Yeah, lots.
Right, so it was causing a lot of conflict. People were really at each other's throats about whether they come home and after a tough day of work, you know, or in the rain, the fog, and they were running into no parking space. Someone took their parking spot, and they would get to know certain people were cheating. And they would then go, you know, and pour paint on their lawn and things like that to get even.
Sure.
People are ingenious in figuring out ways to get even.
Yeah, I've noticed. So
there was lots of conflict in this particular community, and they were doing individual mediations about it. So they were publishing this in the paper, and they began to notice that they were kind of having a huge amount of problems with parking, and there was a lot of conflict in the community. So they called a community meeting on parking. The community board said. And several hundred people came because they were all interested in the subject matter. And what they did is they realized that they were a community and they were having a lot of conflict in their community. And they all agreed that what they needed to do was to pressure the Board of Supervisors of San Francisco to condemn some buildings that were falling apart in one part in the community and create and build a parking structure, which they did. They then began to lobby and annoy the city supervisors. And shortly down the line, they built that parking structure.
There you go.
Brilliant. Shows you what mediation can do, particularly community mediation. Now, San Francisco community boards, my last classes that I taught, I had an advanced conflict resolution course, which were MPA students, Masters of Public Administration. I found a video online on YouTube. And you can look at it yourself. Just Google in or search on YouTube, San Francisco Community Boards Award, 35th anniversary. And the Board of Supervisors of San Francisco had this special ceremony thanking community boards for their 35 years of service. It's about 5 years ago or more, maybe 2015, 2016, something like that. And during the award, guess what? Community boards, because they have four mediators, panels, and they rotate them off and they train new people all the time, have trained 35,000 mediators.
Wow.
35,000 mediators in San Francisco. But now it must be over 40,000, easy. None of them get paid. They do great service for the city and their communities. I love it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. That's awesome. I mean, when you think about, like I said, you know, you don't get trained to do this in school.
No,
nobody gets this as part of a job, really. Maybe some jobs like customer service a little tiny bit, but be able to train that many people and then send them out into a society to do that kind of work. You know, that's sort of a spider bot going out and doing good things, you know, forever. You know, that's awesome.
Yeah. Well, let me give you another example of how we're trained and not trained. In high schools, for sure, and even in grade school, the art of debate is cultivated. Well, debate is an adversarial thing. I mean, actually, they're pre-training you to be lawyers.
Yeah.
It's a debate. It's an adversary. It's a winner and a loser. They score it, things like that. How many classes teach you how to listen? Zero. Pink goose egg. Well, the art of mediation is being a good listener.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's interesting. Like it ties into so much of my communication background, not my rhetoric background, but my interpersonal communication and cultural studies and communication. Mm-hmm. And like part of one of the courses that I've rolled out and that I'm trying to offer to people in the political realm is this idea of converting conservatives. Like if you look at that particular ideology.
Converting conservatives?
Yes. So my argument is for like liberals, quit talking, quit going online or wherever, pick one person and convert one conservative, you know, back over to a liberal or even just a neutral perspective, and you'd never lose another election.
Find common ground. You don't have to convert.
Well, in my world, you do.
I have common ground with Trumpers.
No, in my world, like, I want to convert them. That's what rhetoric does. Rhetoric is much more, it's much more
debate,
not directed. Listening. It's not debate. It's not even adversarial. But it's more about, if I want something in the world, this is a technique for doing it, for causing it to happen. And so using interpersonal techniques to do persuasion conversions makes perfect sense with a hyper aggravated community. Because if you can't listen to them and make them feel comfortable and not threatened, and if you don't have a relationship, they won't let you persuade them. You know, mm-hmm. So all that is just really good foundation for doing good persuasion. And I do ethical only persuasion. Like my whole thing against the right is that they use unethical persuasion techniques to get what they want. And that's dangerous to a democracy. It destroys discourse, versus, you know, ethical only procedures and techniques. If we're taught those, we're fine. I'll debate people forever as long as, you know, they're not coming at me with screed and deception and intimidation, you know, all that negative, unethical talk. And so a lot of that stuff is doing enough interpersonal work so that they can then have a conversion or a persuasion conversation with you. Mm-hmm. So it uses a lot of that stuff. And I've always been fascinated by interpersonal techniques and, mm-hmm. you know, clearly you guys have, you know, weaponized them to the point where they do really good things in the world, you know?
Yeah. Well, but, you know, as I say, some societies, it's routine. I mean, for social harmony. I mean, how do you really get any kind of social harmony in a country that has 1.4 billion people? I mean, it's amazing.
And I think America's having to come to grips with, you know, this kind of heightening of conflict, you know, that is harkening back to the Civil War. It's the only example people have of like, well, it's a new Civil War. And I'm like, you're just pointing out to the point, the worst conflict adversarial position we've ever had, you know?
Putin is getting the rook to move.
Yeah, exactly right, yeah.
People are all pawns of Putin. How much of the stuff that's on social media that these people believe is true is Russian-sponsored stuff? How do they know?
Yeah, oh, it's easy to, like I said, once
how
you
get know?
Unethical techniques.
Well, Putin's nothing but unethical.
Right. That's why, like, the day that they shut down Trump off Twitter, a beautiful silence fell over America. And and everybody was like, oh, my God, this is the way it's supposed to be. I'm not supposed to think about that guy 24 hours a day. You know?
Yeah, I don't, that's for sure. I'm not on Twitter. I don't do social media other than Facebook.
Well, you know, I curate it all very so that I know what I'm getting. Like, I have very strong policies about how I do social media. Like, I do I have a no negativity policy. Like, I don't argue with anybody. They can't disagree with me. All they can do is praise me. If they want to praise me on social media, then they're completely invited to do so. You know, because I like hearing that. I don't want to hear, you know, blowback. So, but. Well, I need to let you go. We've been on for an hour and 15 minutes. This is super fun, Ted.
I've enjoyed it.
Yeah. I'd like to circle around at some point. We'll try another session. You have so much to offer people and
I haven't even begun.
Oh, I know. Trust me. I totally
the stories. And keep in mind the conflict resolution is not my number one thing.
What's your number one thing?
Well, actually, nobody even knows about it. Next.
Basketball? Are you in the NBA? You're still the oldest guy in the NBA?
No, I'm a Knicks fan, actually. I'm a Knicks
kind
fan.
Of the NBA.
Red Sox fan. How about that? I should have talked about a loser.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, I mean, I'm a loser. The New York Giants. Oh, God. All my teams
suck. Giants have had a few years. They've won some Super Bowls.
Both Super Bowls they won by luck. I remember the play.
Who cares? Who cares? They won.
Oh, total luck. That catch on top of the helmet.
Yeah, that was crazy.
I mean, you've never seen that before. You'll never see it again.
Yeah, that was crazy. You know, I'll give you that.
Anyway, but actually, what I'm really about and what my big thing that I failed totally miserably at, me and some guys in Europe who are in together with me on this, we call D3, which is direct deliberative democracy.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what.
Heard about that one a bit.
I have not heard about that one. Let's put a pin in that one. We'll come back around and we'll talk about that one. It's a cool name. I'll tell you that. I like it. All right.
Total failure.
Well, thanks, Ted. I really appreciate it. You know,
Dan, like I said, it was a pleasure. I enjoyed
awesome
it.
To hear guys that really know things. So,
okay.
Appreciate it. And thanks, everybody, for listening to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Head over to rhetoricwarriors.com. Take a persuasion course. Maybe change somebody you don't think you can change. There are actually techniques.
Let's see what happens with this trial. It's not really a trial. It's about persuasion.
Yeah, for sure. Well, everything is about persuasion.
Trying to persuade the other side to their point of view. Let's see who has more success.
Yeah, I agree. It'd be fun to watch.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Ted. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it a lot.